Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself a Gun,
a Sopranos podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Sopranos
and talk about it.
Thank you so much again for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We once again ask you to please give us 5 stars and a review on the Apple Podcast Store. We had some great ones recently. A lot of people commenting a solid B+, which, you know, is you guys, you get the joke. You love the joke, and you're going to keep repeating it, and we appreciate you for that, and I love you all. Don't you love them, Vince?
I love them dearly.
I don't believe you. Also,
it's true.
Also, once again, patreon.com/fraudcast. The $8 tier is the Pod Yourself a Shoutout tier, in which at the end of the episode, we will shout you out and Vince will give you a mafia nickname. This week, we have a bunch of new patrons, dude. So,
hell yeah. That's sick. Can't wait to give some nicknames again.
Oh, dude, I'm very excited to watch you flail for once.
Yeah.
Fucking asshole. It's not. It's usually me flailing. That's the whole thing. And now you're gonna do it.
So. I'll dance for my supper.
And good. Some. You know what? Because I got to give my legs a rest. I've been dancing for my supper for fucking 9 years. Anyways, today is a very special episode of The Sopranos. We're doing season 4, episode 6. Everybody Hurts, and our guest is from the 420 Day Fiance podcast and Private Parts Unknown. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Sophia Alexandra.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. So
I really appreciate being invited.
Well, you know, we just figured, hey, who do we know who watches The Sopranos? And
who else has a podcast with really good pun titles?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we needed both. We needed someone who understands puns in the title and someone who loves podcasting. And we figured who better than someone who writes for television themselves than Sophia Alexandra. So tell us, what are your thoughts? Are you a Sopranos super fan or are you a medium fan?
I am a Sopranos fan.
Oh, okay.
I guess, I think I was introduced to it the way every woman has, at the insistence of a man.
Yeah.
Who would not take no for an answer. And then I married him.
Ooh.
Nice. No, congrats.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. My husband, definitely made me watch it, and I gotta say it was a pretty hard sell because I don't like it when someone's when there's too much cultural discourse about a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I am loath to watch it at the moment because I'm afraid that I won't have my own, I won't be able to have my own experience of it because I'll have heard so much already.
Right, right.
And so when I first watched Sopranos, it was at the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
So that I would know what the finale was about, again, at the insistence of my husband. Yeah. And it didn't make any fucking sense. Why did I fucking need to watch any of Sopranos for that fucking finale? No one needed to see any of the Sopranos for that. But I did really enjoy it. And then I watched the show from the beginning. And wow, so complex. So much hotness. So much heroin use.
Yeah.
Just a lot of everything. Suicidal ideation, men going to therapy. What doesn't it have?
Well, an ending. But other than that.
Yes, other than that, everything.
Yeah, it has everything you could want from a show that ends suddenly for
no really
reason.
It's really a testament to The Sopranos how good it is that, you know, that I can still love a show that consists of so many therapy scenes and dream sequences. Which
yeah,
are,
when, it, when which you hate.
I do.
Which,
yeah, they're like my least favorite things in art, other than like movies about people being numb with grief. I think that's like my least favorite.
Did you not like the scarf scene in this episode?
Oh, wow. Yeah,
it's this... like someone doesn't like a wound metaphor, I guess.
You know, honestly, I liked this dream better than most dream sequences and in most things.
Are you not a fucking fan of the ducks? Again, what is your fucking problem?
Give me the real ducks. I don't want any mind ducks.
Yeah, he wants real life flapping ducks. That's right. What he wants. Vince, and you know, we've gone on record about this. When it comes to all of the things that you love the first time around watching the show, Vince has grown to detest all of those things, and now I only likes the stuff he didn't notice.
I don't think I ever liked Therapy and Dreams. So I'm just gonna say that.
I think you did at some point. I think everybody did at some point. I think before you start a Sopranos podcast, you go in thinking, I'm gonna is talk about dream sequences and ducks and Therapy. And then you start it and you're like, you know what? It's all the other shit that I like. So that's
like the Therapy. I love those scenes, actually.
To me, it always depends on the Therapy scene. Some of it is just like kind of repeating to the audience what you've kind of already pieced together by watching the show.
It's great when it's like an interpersonal dynamic between Melfi and Tony. Therapy scenes in most things are basically like the screenwriter getting interviewed about why they made certain character choices, you know?
Right.
It's like, right, this is what I think they were thinking in this scene. And you're like, okay, well.
Yeah. Sometimes you just watch need to hear things. the screenwriter say the thing that they were thinking about for the art.
Sure.
That's why, like, my favorite part of going to any like gallery is the little square next to the painting that explains the painting.
Yeah.
That's always my favorite.
I also, though, feel like watching a lot of the Therapy scenes like now.
Yeah.
I mean, probably then too, but especially now, you're like, oh, that's not okay.
Yeah.
A lot of that was just like, this is completely outside the boundary of any sort of professional relationship.
Completely. Yeah. There's a few times that we've noticed on this podcast where we've been like, you know, Melfi is getting progressively more unprofessional as she goes along. And I never noticed this before. Like, and this episode actually has a lot of people acting very unprofessionally in their chosen profession. But we'll get into all of that. But first, we must play the theme song.
She'll slap.
Pod. Yourself. Pod. Pod. Podcast. Pod. 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 Podcast. Still slaps indeed, ladies and gentlemen and other. Today we are going to be talking about, from season 4 of The Sopranos, episode 6, Everybody Hurts. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
Tony feels depressed over the negative impact he has on people who don't deserve it, while Carmela tries to set up Furio with a friend. AJ is uncomfortable with his girlfriend's wealth. Artie attempts a new business venture.
Yeah, I mean,
what am I, a fucking toxic person?
What am I, a fucking, am I a toxic, am I exhibiting toxic masculinity over here?
Him repeatedly saying, what am I, a toxic person, was just like, we got it the first time. You didn't say it.
Oh, I love it so much.
You get really just concerned about that when you are in the mafia.
Yeah, right. Sure, I've murdered people, but I'm worried that I'm exhibiting some toxicity. Before we get into that, I mean, when did this premiere and what was happening during the time that it premiered?
Oh, I believe what you're describing is that the inability to judge art outside of its cultural context And the cultural context for this is that it came out October 20th, 2002. And to figure out what was happening right around then, we're going to take a little trip to the Remember When machine.
Walk, walk, daddy, daddy, bop, bop, shoo, bop. Remember then.
Remember.
Remember when is the lowest form of conversation.
So, yeah, October 20th, 2002, a lot of the storylines from the early aughts that we all know and love were really starting to heat up around this time. You know, the DC sniper was still on the loose. He struck again the day before. He has so far killed 9 and wounded 2.
Damn. I remember when that shit was going down because yeah, I was in DC then.
Really?
Because I was in college.
Live there? Yeah. Oh, it was college.
I was in college at George Washington University. And I remember literally all of us being so fucking scared and like being like, okay, well, remember to zigzag. Okay,
yeah. <all right. laughs> Yeah, that's going
to
help.
Just zigzag to class. All right. See you there.
I mean, it's awful, obviously. It's awful. And it's a terrible thing that it happened, and I do feel for all of the victims, but I will say it is very funny that everyone's, like, go-to solution was just make sure you zigzag your way, you know, really keep them guessing.
What
you
should do is dress like a lady bunny and have give them an exploding cigar, you know?
That's all we had back then. It was just...
Yeah.
We didn't have thoughts and prayers back then.
Yeah.
No. It was just zigzagging.
Just zigzagging. That's a great solution.
Another thing we had, you know, the color-coded terror warning system.
Oh, yeah.
So,
that was an orange day. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is from the New York Times. Possibility of using trucks for terror remains concern. This was like a time when we just like invented terror scenarios and made front page articles about them.
Yeah.
What if
they used a truck? Big truck. No. What if they use a Camry? Everybody drive Camry into people. It could happen. Okay, I got another scenario. What if everybody, you know those things, the handshake buzzer? What if that, but it's filled with actual electricity?
I need to know what that voice is.
Oh, this is just a guy who real smart. It's just a smart guy voice. All right. Well, you know what? I don't need your judgment. I went to UC Santa Cruz. Okay.
Other things that were happening, you know, we were building up to go invade Iraq, which is like the longest, most telegraphed invasion in world history. It's got to be.
Yeah, we're going to do it.
No, we might do it tomorrow. This is from the New York Times. From its palaces, Iraq's view of the world is a world filled with allies. As Iraq confronts the possibility of a new war with the United States, its leaders appear to have concluded that they have one decisive advantage that they lacked during the countdown to the Persian Gulf War 12 years ago. This time, they seem convinced, the world is on their side and against the United States. The world has abandoned America. It has become isolated, Saddam Hussein's number two man, Izzat Ibrahim, boasted as he announced the result of this week's election. Iraqis, by official reckoning, had re-elected Saddam Hussein to his position of absolute power as president with 100% of the 11.4 million votes cast.
Wait. I'm sorry. Starting that quote with his number two man says, is like being like, newspaper headline, Sophia most beautiful, says mother.
Exactly.
What do you mean? Yeah, he's your number two. That's literally his only job. Is to just say yes and agree with you.
And might I say, he's a very handsome boy too.
What a handsome number two man you have.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, and after we invaded, I'm sure we killed his number two man about 15 different times.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That definitely was like the biggest thing. It's like, oh, Al-Qaeda number two. In lighter news, you know, we had the, we go to the Post for our lighter news.
Gotta love the Post.
You gotta love this headline. Teutonic turkeys turning terror lair into art.
What?
The German apartment where Mohammed Atta plotted the September 11th attacks.
Oh, all right.
is being turned into an art happening this week.
Oh my God, they're gentrifying someone's home. Like they're gentrifying an Al-Qaeda operative's home. I love it.
Avant-garde artists from Berlin are planning an exhibit of paintings, videos.
No, keep it how it is, okay? I want to remember this city how it was meant to be remembered.
It's a historical
landmark. With
Al-Qaeda
operatives on every corner. Keep New York, New York, am I right?
Next Friday and Saturday at the three-room Hamburg apartment in a nondescript building at Marienstrasse 54. The aim of the show, called Marienstrasse 54 Space Cleaning, is to depict everyday life in the area. The exhibition has divided residents in the Harburg district, where the apartment building is located. Many feel it denigrates the memory of the dead to have an art show in a place where atrocities were planned.
Can you explain the turkeys part?
I guess they're just jerks. I mean, it alliterates, man. Come on.
Oh, I see. I see. So they are insulting the Teutonic. They're saying these fucking Teutonic turkeys are turning a terrorist lair into art.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see. I see. This is an outrage.
Giving that word not a meaning that it's ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's
like a jive turkey, but very blonde and Aryan featured.
Yeah. Right. A Teutonic turkey is just a little Zach Morris turkey going around trying to find its screech.
Little Orange County turkey.
A little Orange County turkey. Well, you know, I do love all of the terror-related news stories, obviously. It's a wonderful time to be alive in America. But what were some of the movies and music that was happening?
Well, before the movies and the music, we have to go to sports. You know, Barry Bonds hit a home run in his first at-bat of Game 1 of the World Series.
Oh, that's fun.
Here comes another hit, Barry Bonds.
The Giants won. Yeah, you know what? I miss steroids. I'll say it. Baseball was better when they did lots of steroids.
Steroid baseball was a really exciting time for baseball. It was, you know, back when America was great.
And Barry Bonds should be in the damn Hall of Fame because he was the best at doing steroids. A lot of people did them. Barry Bonds did them better. You gotta reward
that's
that.
The thing, though. I feel like at a certain point, that just means that you're still the best.
Yeah, right.
It's like everybody was doing them. He was still better than everybody who did them.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's like still, if you add the same coefficient to two sides of an equation, I've never said that before.
No, yeah, that sounded right.
That sounds hell smart. Right.
Yeah, you sound pretty smart, to be honest with you. Do you want to think of ways for terrorists to do terror? You sound way smart.
I don't know if you ever heard of a wagon. Two wheels, I pull it.
Oh. Top movies in the country, The Ring, Sweet Home Alabama, and Red Dragon. The top pop song was Dilemma by Nelly, featuring Kelly Rowland.
Sick.
And the top rock song was Never Again by Nickelback.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah, dude. Yep. It was just an amazing time for music and art.
Mm, yeah.
The Ring came out. That was the opening weekend for The Ring. The first scary movie that ever scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. Yeah.
Oh, I don't think I've still ever seen The Ring, but I just know it has that girl with the hair, right?
Yeah, it's the girl with the hair, but that's not even the scariest. The scariest part is you see someone who gets scared to death and you see their body and their face is all like, ah, and it's just like, I couldn't sleep for like 2 weeks without the lights on. So,
but that's not a thing that happens.
Yeah, but it's scary though, because you, especially if you're like, you know, if you don't, I mean, I think I was like 17, 16
at the time. That's how ghosts have to kill people.
Right. I remember when like Scream came out when I was in high school, and that legitimately fucked me up for like
that scared you? See, I was never scared of it because I was just like, I don't know any killers.
Yeah.
Well, no, because I was always alone. When you're like an only child with a single mom who's always working.
Yeah.
And like, you know how to get into your own living room by just sliding the window up. You're like, oh, I'm going to fucking die here. It's just how it goes. And anytime the phone would ring, because it was before cell phones, I would just be like, ah! Yeah.
Well, as a white male, the only way the only threat I can think of is Supernatural. So I'm like, I'm like, yeah, maybe a ghost could happen. And you're like, no, I'm just thinking like an actual killer comes into that. I'm like, no, I'm not scared of that. I never considered it. Oh, well, let's get into this episode. So once again, we are talking about Everybody Hurts. This is the episode in which, I mean, you know, this is kind of like the big suicide episode. You know, we talk about suicide a lot. We talk about, you know, depression, self-medication, all of that stuff. And written, the synopsis
written by Michael Imperioli and directed by Steve Buscemi.
Oh, nice. That's a good pairing right there.
They kind of look alike, good. Too.
They yeah, do.
They're
well,
both kind of weird looking.
They're both...
No, they like got like eye...
They got the buggy eyes.
Prominent eye, yeah. Nose yeah. Situation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, no offense to any of our Italian listeners, both, but some of your heroes are ugly as sin.
They both look very Italian. It's like, oh, it's like that old Theo Von...
I didn't say that in a negative way. Who are two big-nosed Jews up in here being like, actually, our Italian brothers are real weird-looking.
No, it's...
No. That's not what I'm here for.
No, it's like that Theo Von joke where he was talking about how he... The only person with Down syndrome he knew was also like an Irish kid, and he just thought like he was really Irish. Like that's kind of like he's like,
he
oh, he's like
he was extra
I just thought he was like 300% Irish. I like Steve Buscemi and Michael Imperioli just look like they're like, you know, 175% Italian.
They look very Italian. They're very Italian people. But you know what, Michael Imperioli, very handsome man.
I would
know.
Say he's like. I mean, I'm
also
not...
young. Steve Buscemi was hot.
Sure,
young Steve Buscemi did have a thing.
I think
he had like yeah.
Like a lot of actors, they're kind of like ugly hot, like Willem Dafoe kind of thing. You know, where they're like so odd looking.
No,
that
I
they're...
think that's a different category. That's sure. The man crag factor.
Yeah,
that's like your Clint Eastwoods, your. You know what I'm talking about. Man crag face. It's
yeah.
Like a very specific craggy look that yeah. Lets everybody know that like...
That you fucked you,
your dick is fucking hard as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With
yeah.
Maybe
super
like knots
dick.
On it, like a Joshua tree.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Burled ass dick.
Exactly.
But so the episode is called Everybody Hurts. And that synopsis was fine. But I have my own synopsis.
It's the only episode named after an R.E.M. song.
I know. And what a better way to get into that than to play the Bada B stories.
Wish you would ask me for a loan, my friend. You could give cash for Almanac to a shady Frenchman. And if you don't ask me, I will say again, am I a toxic person? The angry boy, Artie Bucco, gets ripped off for his squirrel and his midlife crisis earring. Tony finds out from his wife, Gloria Trillo took her life by hanging from a chandelier. Now everyone he knows is getting money. His way to say, can we put the past away? Wished you would ask me for a loan, my friend. We could pretend that in the end I won't be collecting interest. The ashes of your life are dividends. Am I a toxic person? My nephew's on heroin. My son thinks I'm a garbage man.
So that wasn't R.E.M.
Did you...
That was just Third Eye Blind.
Did you have to find a drum set for that?
You think I did the track myself?
I don't know. It sounded fairly homemade.
It did. It definitely did. No, I just looked up...
That was fucking amazing, okay?
Yeah, thank you. I looked up Third Eye Blind karaoke, and that was the one I found. And I will admit, I was like, the drums seem poorly done.
They seem very homemade. It's yeah, like when I'm, but it's like it gives it character. It's like when I make tortillas at home and they're not quite round.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was. The
Aren't you not- a precious baby boy?
Oh man. Anyways, so I don't know why I thought the misdirection of not playing REM was funny in my head, but I take it back.
I mean, Third Eye Blind is always very fertile ground for parody.
So yeah, that was pretty much covering all of the Bada B stories. You know, we've got a lot of suicide. We've got a lot of wanksterism. This is an episode.
Yeah, it's mostly Tony worrying that he's a toxic person and AJ not realizing that his girlfriend is slumming by dating him.
It's one of the most depressing and pathetic. Like, it's a parade of, like, sad, pathetic tragedy.
Yeah.
And then some really killer, hilarious lines.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh,
it's actually,
yes, for sure.
I mean, it's actually so brutal that it, like, almost.
It's a great episode, yeah, actually.
It, like, almost made me feel bad for AJ at certain points in the episode.
Yeah.
Which is impressive.
It is. It is. Yeah.
I mean, like, she bought a $3,000 statue, man. I'm woke now, okay, dude?
Yeah.
This fucking car service strip's really fucking woken me.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
I still want to go fuck at my sisters, but will I be thinking about something else during it? No.
Yeah.
I will be thinking about your pussy.
So it opens, you know, Chrissy and Aid are doing heroin, and Chrissy gets a call from Tony that he's got to meet him in the Webendorfer's parking lot, and it just made me think about you, Matt. Like, how easy is it to snap yourself out of a nod when you have to go and do something?
It's incredibly difficult, but also this again, Sopranos is doing a great job having relatable heroine moments. Yeah, I mean, they did do a little bit of the kind of the cliche thing where he's like looking in a mirror and shit like that, which is like, come on. No,
and
he's
like,
not.
What's inside my eye? Am I a cyborg?
Who have I become? It's just like, that's not what
no,
you
No, I've never
do.
Seen a junkie ever do that.
No, no. It's not something that, you know, if you're someone who stares in the mirror regularly, maybe then that's a thing. But no, you would definitely not be doing that. But what you would be doing is doing exactly what they were doing in the opening scene, which is being high on heroin and just watching the History Channel. That is absolutely right. Back when I was using, I used to do this thing where I would go find like a cafe somewhere and then I would go do drugs in the bathroom, and then I would sit like outdoor patio and just open a book and fall asleep, and it would be a thing where I would just be like, I'm learning, but you're like, just because I'm a junkie doesn't mean I can't be a useful, smart, informed member of society. And then you just immediately you're immediately nodding out.
Did you ever do like the movie thing where you pass out on the public bathroom floor and someone like bumps into you with the door or anything like that?
No, that's never happened to me. But you know that, because again, that's like the movie thing. I'm sure that has happened, but not, it doesn't happen as often as someone just being in their apartment on heroin watching the History Channel or going to work. And that's another thing he does, is so he shows up at the parking lot to meet Tony, and he's just trying to like snap himself out of nodding out. And he does, I have to say, Michael Imperioli does a great job being on heroin on the show as like an acting challenge, because he's not doing like the junkie lean. He's not trying to like do any of the tropes. He's just, he's doing the thing where you're just speaking loudly whenever it's your turn to speak in hopes that loud speaking will keep you awake.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought that was like a brilliant
Basically,
touch.
Trying to fake being awake and alert at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course I'm awake. Awake people yell. It's like, it was perfect.
It's like he's trying to yes and Tony, but he's clearly hasn't understood and taken and synthesized all the things that he's just heard. So he just like,
no, he's concentrating really hard on yelling his next sentence, and like he's only responding to the very last thing that he just said, and it's a brilliant job in that scene. You know, he's like, well, I have a clip.
Over the next couple of years, more and more, I'm going to be giving my orders through you. You're going to take this family into the 21st century.
We're already in the 21st century, though, T. Whatever you say, T, I'd follow you into the gates of hell. That's what I was going to say to you. What you did for me, that fuck who killed my father. I'll never forget that. I only hope I'm worthy.
Why wouldn't you be worthy?
Just saying.
Hey, not for nothing, T. It's already the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, speak out of turn here, but that already happened like a year ago. So the fuck you talking about? Yeah,
I want to put on my symbolism hat for a minute.
Oh, please do.
Which I know.
I'm intrigued and scared.
As a fan of dreams and and therapy on the show, I'm sure, Vince, you're really excited about this. But the stuff that Chris and Adriana are watching on TV, that history documentary about pyramids.
Yeah.
It talks about the last thing kind of that's the big line of it is they go, the biggest feat of the pyramids isn't the actual, like, our engineering feat. It's the feat of cooperation. Right?
Sure.
An organization.
Yeah.
And I just, and it shows like all those guys like uniting together and like padding that pyramid.
Yeah.
And then it shows what an absolute dipshit Chris is.
Yeah. The weak link in the chain.
Yeah. Tony's like, you know, like we're building this together. It's an empire. And he's like completely fucking high. And it's just, I think, a really nice way to be like, yeah, this is never going to be anything. You can't build an empire on shit.
Yeah.
It's just never going to happen for you guys.
You can't build it on a foundation of junkies.
Yeah.
No.
It's also, we've pointed this out before, but like that this is another Michael Imperioli written episode, and he always writes Christopher as dumber than any of the other Sopranos writers.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely, which I think means that he is the only one who actually gets Chris. He's the only writer in the Sopranos writers room that actually understands why Chris is a great character, because he only writes him as a dummy and a fuck up, and rather than, like, you know, there were attempts in previous episodes and previous seasons to write him as he's a fuck up, but he's like, I don't know.
He's the young,
cool.
Yeah, he's the young, cool one who's like into Hollywood and like semi more woke than, you know, Tony or Polly. But
right.
But yeah.
Well, I think to me they wrote him like the movie Crash, you know, where it's like it's a thing that you think is smart when you're stupid.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and they've written Chris the same way where he's like, this is a guy who thinks he's smart.
Right.
And in that exactly like demonstrates how fucking stupid he is.
Yeah. Well, they pulled the old,
he imagines himself to be this intellectual. Yeah. And he's like, no, this is what scripts are. And this is reading.
Right.
He doesn't understand any of it.
Well, that's
he's
why
more
he's
of a dilettante.
Watching, yeah. He's watching the History Channel.
Tom Friedman'd his ass.
They did.
I understand the Middle East because I took a taxi ride one time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other great thing about this scene is that Tony's big idea for how to run a successful business is to trust his own family more, which, like, historically is the absolute worst way to run anything.
Yeah. He's like, you know what? The one thing they're not is they're not blood.
Yeah.
And like, part of me was,
they didn't get to where, like, you're the only one who didn't get here because of merit. So obviously I got to promote you.
Exactly. So clearly you're the correct choice. No, I love it. He's like, yeah, you know, blood matters more. And he's just like, my blood's filled with heroin.
Yeah. And that's also why monarchies work out so fucking great.
Yeah. No monarchy has ever gone downhill because of the nepotism
massive
involved.
Inbreeding, because that's how badly you wanted your blood to fucking keep your organization tight.
Keep the organization pure.
So then, you know, we move into the other, I guess the next storyline is Tony finding out that Gloria Trillo is dead now. And
yeah, that is, I mean,
which,
that's a,
yeah,
that's kind of a main storyline. I was thinking, you know, what about AJ?
Yeah.
I think AJ has a perfect little side story going
well,
on.
Well, there's, those are the two main ones. So yeah, AJ.
There's so many funny things about that.
AJ has gone to him. Like the rich school, which I think is like the worst thing that you can do for any, everybody's obsessed with getting their kid into like a good school. But to me, like the scariest thing is having my kid go to a school with a bunch of kids that are richer than he is, and they all turn mm-hmm. into just a bunch of little elitist pieces of shit.
Yeah.
And it's like the AJ storyline's so great because there's an arc where it's like painful at first because he's turned into a rich shithead, and then it's even more painful when you identify him with him realizing that what he thinks, what he's proud of is very pathetic compared to all of his actually rich friends.
Yeah, it's sad because, you know, he is faking it in multiple different ways in this episode. Like, the one way he's faking it is that he is happy to just openly talk about the mafia with outsiders because it might get him pussy, which is just like it's exactly what you would expect like a middle school new metal kid to do. Yeah. You know, or I guess he's in high school now. Like, he's like no respect for the idea that this whole thing is supposed to be, yeah, you know, hush hush.
It's all built on silence and never talking about the mafia. And then, like, the very next generation is like, yes, I will sell out my entire family for one crumb of pussy.
Yeah. Just,
and
please.
Also,
yeah.
Can we talk about how he takes advice on getting pussy from fucking bowl cut?
Paul,
yes,
Dano?
Dude, that's fucking Paul Dano.
Yeah.
The amazing actor, Paul Dano.
He's incredible, but
yes,
no one who looks like that should ever give you advice right. about anything.
It's what makes it so perfect.
It's so funny. And he's just like, yeah, uh-huh, tell me more about that. She's ready. She's fucking ready.
It's Paul Dano has a small but mighty cameo in this. And of course, this is Paul Dano before he became fucking Paul Dano, before he was in There Will Be Blood,
you know,
before he was in...
You know what's weird about this is that like Paul Dano was really good in this. And I remember thinking that after Little Miss Sunshine, that Paul Dano was like one of the worst actors in the world. Cause like in Little Miss Sunshine, he does like the Wiley Wiggins in Dazed and Confused thing where it's like His entire like acting move in that is just to be like sullen and look away all the time. Mm-hmm. And now I realize that the Little Miss Sunshine just didn't know how to direct Paul Dano, I guess, because he was like a good actor before. And then he's a great actor in like There Will Be Blood. But then in that movie, he's just terrible.
I haven't rewatched that since I saw it in theaters. I don't really remember.
Yeah, I would need to rewatch it to see him being bad in it. I remember not being him being in it, but not being impressed by his performance. But yeah,
right.
No.
Well, I remember watching There Will Be Blood and thinking, "Holy shit, Paul Dano can actually act!" I thought this guy
was incredible. Yeah. He's incredible. But I do have a clip of Paul Dano explaining to AJ how to get the pussy.
The thing is to keep knocking on the door without going in right away. You gotta poke the perimeter and tap on the gate until she's out of her fucking mind and begging. Then you own that shit. That pussy's yours. I think she's ready. We shall know forsooth.
we shall know forsooth. Oh my god, the brilliance of that line.
Methinks thou hast that nerd.
You guys should make merch that says that.
We shall
honestly
know forsooth.
We shall know
forsooth. I would buy
forsooth
a shirt that said that.
I absolutely agree. That shit is, it's just so goddamn brilliant because that fucking nerd virgin telling him how to get the pussy ready like it's just beautiful. But the AJ storyline opens up with him drinking and smoking cigarettes with his friend. With his friends, including Paul Dano and his girlfriend, his new girlfriend, Devin.
Devin Pillsbury.
Yeah.
Right. Quite amazing.
That is definitely like the kind of WASP name that a Guido would make up.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah
also really fucked up to me that they didn't actually make her an heir to the Pillsbury fortune. It was right fucking there. You told me she was insanely rich. That's the first thing I thought. I was like, she's that Pillsbury.
Yeah, she's
gotta
be.
And then they
were
like, oh, her dad's a financial guy. Why did you do that? Let her be the Pillsbury dough girl. What's your problem?
And by the way, that actress's name, which is almost as good of a WASP name, is I feel like it's more realistic to the character. Her real name is Jessica Dunphy, which
that's definitely a more realistic WASP
name. I know a girl named that.
Uh-oh.
Oh yeah,
Jessica Dunphy.
Maybe she's your friend.
Who is that? Okay, you know what? It's
that's
not
Devin. But I have a clip of them sitting around and talking to AJ about his family.
It's true, dude. They're going to start a draft.
There's no fucking way I'm going to the army.
Uh-oh. You know what that sound means. That sound means that they just did an offhanded reference to 9/11. Via talking about the draft and the army, and you catch my drift,
which means
it is time for our segment, Who Did 9/11, in which I ask our guest who did 9/11. So, Sophia Alexandra, who did 9/11?
Okay, did someone tell you?
What? What's that?
I'm just saying, did someone tell you something? It just is like a weird thing to bring up out of nowhere. Did someone say something to you about my involvement?
This is just a random question.
Did someone fucking tell you something?
I know nothing.
Who fucking was it?
I literally know nothing.
Who was it? Can we get the producer back, Brent? Who fucking said something?
Nobody said nothing. It just...
Brent!
It's part of a... Brent, can you assure her real quick that nobody said anything?
I certainly did not say anything. I apologize for Matt. I don't know what he's on, but...
Nobody said...
You fucking better kiss your kids a final time tonight, Brent.
All right, so in conclusion...
Okay, can we move on? That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure. Well... In conclusion, kind of sounds like Sophia did 9/11. So, back to this scene. I have the full.
That was like so painfully hitting close to home for my high school days, where there's like two drunk dumbasses trying to wrestle each other, which would have been me, and then like the one friend who might get laid that night, and everybody like in the same room for some reason.
Yeah, no, that was pretty close to my high school experience. I think specifically, there was a time in ninth grade where it was right before I started like smoking weed with friends. So instead of weed, people were doing cigarettes because they were like, well, we got to smoke something and I don't know where to get weed. So the idea, I just love watching Paul Dano pull out a cigarette and smoke it as if he's a smoker.
Yeah.
It just rang very, very true to me.
That's a great memory for me because I was like the first one of my friends. I had the first birthday among my like circle of friends. So on midnight of my 18th birthday, we went, you know, to like the little liquor store to buy cigarettes. And the clerk would not sell cigarettes to me after midnight on my birthday because in her mind I wasn't 18 yet, and we were trying to convince her like no, it's after midnight, that means it's the day,
it's a new day.
Yeah, it's a new day. And she's like, well, look, I don't know about that. My shift starts at 7. Like,
your birthday is based on when her shift starts.
Yeah, like her idea of when the date changes was like, look, my shift doesn't start until this, and that's when the new day begins.
She's
for
like,
me.
I'm sorry, I haven't worked here for 18 years, so you actually cannot buy cigarettes here.
Technically, you are about 4 weeks old. I've been here for four weeks. Until I see you here consistently for 18 years. Oh, that's amazing.
We were so just dumbfounded by her logic. We were like, are we being punked? What's happening right now?
So the boys are sitting around. They're talking about, you know, like him, you know, your father's going to put a horse's head in a senator's bed to keep you out of the draft. And then they're like, they're bringing up all this like Godfather stuff. And he's just kind of playing along because he's like, the only thing he knows about the life is kind of based on things he has heard other people say around him. Like, he's like, oh, it doesn't work like that anymore. Yeah. You know, talking about no one's going to shoot up my home.
The only thing he knows about the life is that it gives him social status in this weird way. Yeah.
Yeah. And And someone mentions obviously that his father owns a strip club, and they decide to like drive down to it, but they end up going to the pork store because he remembered an address vaguely, and he thought it might be the Bing, but instead it is Satrial's. And just again,
perfect high school logic where you're like, well, we're not going to get into the strip club, but we could drive down there and watch people come in and out.
Yeah. Because the strippers are coming out naked, you know, yeah, the way that you do when you leave work and go to work.
You know how strippers are just always naked? You know, that's the thing about strippers, you know, whether they're in the club, on a bus, you know.
That's how they get the job.
That's how they get the job. They walk around and someone goes, you should be a stripper.
Yeah. You're naked all the time. This should work out for you.
But you can see the embarrassment, obviously, on you know, AJ's face when, you know, they get down there. It's a pork store. And the guy is like, oh, is this a gay strip club? Which is like, this is great. And they're like, no, it's a front, like Janko olive oil. And then he goes, yeah, like Janko. He's got no idea. He doesn't. Yeah. He's agreeing.
Yeah, you think they make olive oil, but actually they make pants.
They make beautiful jeans. So we get to a scene in which AJ and Devin are making out, and it's one of my
the sweet strains of D'Angelo.
I was just gonna say that to me was such a perfect detail.
Yes, yes, it was.
How does it feel?
That's great because I gotta give them respect for that, because if that was high school me, I would have been playing like some sort of smooth ska band and thinking it was sexy.
I lost my
virginity to the Vandals.
Oh hell yeah. Oh wow. Which song? Which album?
Ape Drape. No one wanted that.
Oh my god, did we date in high school?
This was in college. Okay. I was 17. It was my freshman year, and boy.
Good times, good times.
Hitler bad, Vandals good. Josh Free, still the best drummer out there.
I lost my virginity to deafening silence.
I lost mine to whale sounds.
Really?
Yeah.
You fucked a whale?
Yeah. She had a tape
You fucked Justin Halpern's mom?
Yeah.
Just catching strays. Anyways, yeah, no, so they're playing D'Angelo, and the greatest thing ever is Carmela shows up and asks him to turn down the music, and AJ's got a boner, and he's doing the boner walk, which is a beautiful little detail.
Maybe that's why Janko pants were invented, was to hide boners.
Interesting. I never actually considered that.
You can smuggle a lot of boners in Janko.
It makes sense because back then, also, everybody wore boxers.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you couldn't even, like, properly tuck your boner up if you needed to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was...
You just had to fucking hide it in the fabric, you know, otherwise.
It was a nightmare. God, boners came so easily back then. What happened? What happened? It's just like... You know, I mean, I still get them, but it's just like back then I was afraid of them.
Yeah.
They would just show up. And
if you just thought about not having a boner, you would get a boner.
You would get a boner thinking about your dick. You think about your own dick and get a boner. God, life was so cool. All right. So he does a boner dance. They're looking for a place to, you know, to fuck, that's what it seemed like. They were looking for a place to fuck.
Yeah.
They never actually say have sex.
Well, because it's, that's just, AJ wouldn't ask that because he's hopeful that it might happen. And if you mention it, the possibility just dissipates.
That's what I was thinking too. And I was thinking, like, he's still a virgin at this point is what I'm thinking. And I think he does not know whether or not she wants to have sex. He assumes she wants to have sex, but I don't think Devin's about to have sex with this guy.
I love the logic there that the plan to find an empty room to have sex in is to go to your sister's college dorm room. That is the most insane plan that only like a kid in Janko pants would come up with.
Yeah.
Because it's like you only know like not that many people. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you're like, okay, is it your house? No. Is it my house? No.
Yeah.
Okay, do any of our friends have a house? No. Yeah. Okay, the only other person I know is my sister.
Yeah. That's true.
So it's I better go there.
Yeah. You run down the list and you go like, I gotta fuck on my sister's bed. So they go all the way
She'll be cool with it.
Yeah, I love the logic there. Just be like, she thought they were going to visit just to like, and that's I love it because in that scene, she's like, says, actually, I have a clip of that as well.
Which clip is that?
AJ Wanna Smash is the name of the clip.
Are you sure this is it?
Brook Avenue and 161st Street, South Bronx.
Don't leave, okay?
Chiyoke, this is my little brother. I'm Meadow, Lightness Man's sister.
I'm Devin. Hi.
Can I talk to you? I need to use your room.
What for?
You know.
You've got to be kidding. Anthony, no.
Just for a little while. Why not?
I don't even want to think about it. It's my bed. How am I going to go in there after?
We'll just stay on the coverlet.
No.
We came all the way over here.
I thought you wanted to go into the city. There's all this stuff going on. I thought we'd go to the Alphabets. A friend of mine's sister's reading. She's a novelist.
That's right.
Probably just going to cruise. Is the tree up at Rockefeller Center yet?
Can I just say, she literally suggests the opposite of sex. She's like, no, I thought we were going to go to a novelist reading tonight. like, if there's one thing that Meadow knows how to do successfully, it's say the exact opposite thing of what AJ wants. So one thing leads to another. They don't fuck. AJ and Devin are talking about how rich they are and how I love it. In the scene in which they're talking about how rich they are also dunking on their friend who's poor.
Yeah. His dad's a math teacher.
But also, yeah, the idea of what they think is really poor is also like so hilarious to me.
Yeah.
But wait, before we move on, I just really quickly wanted to say that I think that it's crazy that even Meadow thought that her brother would be interested in any form of reading.
Right.
Yeah.
Like
whether it would be to him or like,
well, they're perfect.
Have you met him?
They're perfect siblings because they can't imagine the thought process of anyone but themselves. So they just immediately just assume like whatever they're thinking is how other people think.
Yeah. Like, AJ is obviously being a dick himself in just being like, I want to use your room to fuck, and thinking that's an okay thing to say. But also Meadow being like, this is the center of culture in America, and you want to use it for sex instead of reading? And it's like, fuck you, you fucking nerd.
And then he wants to go to Rockefeller Center, and she's like equally horrified.
Yeah, she's horrified that he wants to see the tree at Rockefeller Center, which is like, fuck you. That's a nice tree. If you're from New Jersey, that's the nicest tree.
And it's great.
Also, it's big. I'm sorry.
It's a big tree. Really? Who doesn't want to see a big tree?
It's great.
The idea that she's scoffing at a tree. It's like, fuck off, Meadow.
How big is that novel that bitch is going to read?
I bet it's not as big as the tree.
I bet it's regular ass size, huh?
Yeah. I bet they had to kill a fucking Rockefeller Center tree just to make it. Fuck that shit.
And then the idea that he's lived within driving distance of New York City like his entire life, and he gets there and knows absolutely nothing about it.
Yeah, that's real. That's the realest shit ever. Yeah. I love that. It's like when I went to UC Santa Cruz and fucking everyone else had to tell me about all the cool stuff in LA. And I was like, I don't know what Pink's hot dogs are, but there's a train tracks near my house where you can drink.
Yeah.
Like that's the shit that I fucking had to tell. There's an AMC movie theater in Century City that
And it was very real just watching like AJ's progression, because it reminded me of going to college where, like, growing up in Reedley, I had an idea of what I thought like a rich person was like, and then I didn't realize like, oh no, that's like what, like everyone in Reedley is completely poor compared to every person that I went to college with. And like our idea of what constituted a rich person was like sad and pathetic compared to whatever they did.
Yeah. And you know, I think AJ learns that he's not privileged, and I think probably I don't know. It's in a very relatable way in which, like, he just goes to a bigger house. Yeah, and realizes
and then there's also, like, they're talking about the Godfather, and his idea of a mob boss is like the main boss, and his dad is like the boss of northern New Jersey. Like, he is some, like, provincial compared to, like, the real mafia, and he has not realized this entire time.
And it's incredibly embarrassing for him, especially given the fact that, you know, he had this whole ride in, you know, the fucking in Devin's driver's car.
And then they go to her house, and he's like, ah, she's not even that rich. Look at this shitty house, not realizing that oh no, that's just the guard house.
Which is crazy.
To let them into the giant ass fucking property like situation that was just, and watching him, I mean, I feel like as big a miss as them saying, having Meadow being like, do you want to go listen to the novelist, is when they had AJ recognize Picasso's.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, okay, all right. There's a lot of wishful thinking going on here.
I thought the same thing too.
Yeah. And then he's like so insecure that he can't capitalize on the fact that she's slumming with him. Like, he could have totally gone with that. Like, he didn't quite realize that she was slumming, and he could have played that to the hilt, but he was too busy feeling insecure.
Like he was a mob boss. He was when she was kissing him, saying, "Ooh, I'm some gangster guy's girlfriend." Like, he still saw them as, like, not even as equals. He was like, "Yeah, we're both rich, but I'm also gangster." And now he's realizing that she's slumming and that she is, you know, dating someone way beneath her.
I have a different take on it.
Oh,
I think, to me, I feel like AJ's, there's like, to me, there's two layers. Like, one is that AJ's whole thing is he doesn't have an identity.
Yeah.
And that is a thing that is his whole journey throughout the entire series.
Totally.
He just doesn't have an identity, and he tries to find one constantly, and he just can't. And it's like pretty pathetic to watch him struggle. And he doesn't believe in himself, and his parents didn't give him any tools to, like, learn to find out who he is.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's just kind of, like, fucked altogether. He's never even been in a place where he had to try hard, because he's kind of a mediocre kid. And that's fine. That's, you can have mediocre abilities in a billion things and then find out something you're great at.
Right.
That's how life works.
Exactly.
You're mostly mediocre at most things and just great at a couple or one.
Right. Or you end up just liking something and you go, oh, I could do this. But he's never.
Yeah. And by
really
great, I guess, I mean, just even the joy, like any kind of pleasure, any kind of a sense of, like, goodness, he's never found that. And I feel like, you know, with this whole, like, playing the dangerous kid in this rich school, he was like, oh, I do have an identity here. I'm like someone special. My special thing is this thing, even if I don't know that much about it.
Right.
It's like, but that sets me apart.
Right.
And I think when he realized, oh, she's rich too, it's like, well, now I'm uncomfortable.
Right.
I'm not special. And then he finds out she's even richer than him. So now in his mind, she's the special one. And he's the ordinary one.
Yeah.
And I think what that leads me to is my second point, which is power.
Mm.
And I think what's really sad and kind of, like, awful about him as a person is that he can only really be in relationships with women when he feels like he has power over them.
Yeah, he's blind to what he's lucked into in this situation because he doesn't have the power anymore.
And he just doesn't
he's not able to find, I bet you he couldn't get hard after that.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what that boner thing was too in the beginning.
Now he's walking around.
I'm dangerous. And now he's unimpeded. Like, ugh, I don't want to fuck you because, like, it was only fun and cool for me when I had the power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, now
you've sucked all the blood out of my boner.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I got sad dick now.
I think you're right. In this episode, he starts off with two non-earned identities. You know, he starts off with two identities that were gifted to him by his family. One being the mafia, two being money. And he ends with neither because he realizes he doesn't have as much money as he thought he did, at least compared to Devin. And it ends with them saying, hey, how come your dad doesn't have all that stuff? And he's like, I don't know. So he's like, also, my dad is part of the trash mafia, I guess, because, you know.
Like, literally, because he's in waste management.
He's literally in waste management. But, yeah, that, I think that's an excellent and astute point, which is a rare thing that we have on this podcast. So I'm going to edit it out, and how dare you.
That's fair. No, and, like, Meadow is such the opposite always of him. Because she's so driven. So in addition to being like smarter or whatever, she also has all this ambition and drive. Mm-hmm, she might be shitty like Tony,
right,
but she's also driven like Tony.
Yeah, she's got some more, she's more motivated. She shares some of the, I guess, manipulation traits of the, in the Soprano genes, but she's not a floating upper middle class kid the way AJ is, kind of like this floating fail son who doesn't know what he wants or who he is. But yeah, that's his storyline. Now let's get into the main stuff with Tony and Artie. So this is the episode.
Ugh, heartbreaker.
It's a heartbreaking episode to watch for Artie Bucco. Artie Bucco starts off this episode talking to a French man who's convincing him to invest in Armagnac, which is a type of alcohol that I had never heard of until I watched this particular episode of The Sopranos.
So the first time we were watching this, me and my husband, and I said to him, what the fuck is Armagnac? I was like, I've never heard of it. He's like, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like every European country has their own weird digestif, and they're all basically the same, but they each have like a different one. You know, like the Italians have like Fernet Branca, and the Germans have like Unterberg, and the Hungarians have Svach. It's all like everybody has like a weird shot of gross herbaceous things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they all think it's special, even though it's basically the same.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds nasty, whatever it is. But, you know, the French man is doing a good job of explaining it to him. And you see that Artie is clearly being manipulated by, what's her name? Elote?
Elodie.
That can't be right.
Elodie. Which is Elodie. Great because, you know, you can tell that Artie has drunk the Kool-Aid because he calls her Elodie. And then Charmaine immediately comes in and bursts the bubble and is like, Elodie, where's your dang tables? Go clean off the dishes.
Yeah. Table 5 needs cleaning, Elodie.
Yeah. and he, every time he mentions the Frenchman, he goes, Jean-Philippe. He makes sure to do it with a French accent.
Yeah, he puts some stank on it. And
he puts some stank on it. Yeah, yeah. Because he thinks like, ooh, French, those are the refined people. Not thinking at all that this French man is about to rip him off. So Artie is also doing wankster shit, just like AJ. He thinks because of his proximity to the mafia that he somehow has the same kind of toughness. And to this Frenchman, he's going to be a scary guy.
And he has such strong Milhouse's dad energy. Remember when Milhouse's dad gets divorced? Like Artie is just has like
he
the
moves
most
into the divorced dad apartments.
Yeah.
Yes. That's exactly.
Oh my God.
And it's like his fucking Milhouse's dad vibe is flourishing in this episode. He's got a fucking.
Also
he's got
combined with old Gil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strong old Gil energy.
He's definitely like, oh, I got to get that 50 grand. My
old
daughter needs
Gil's
orthodontist.
Never going to be nobody. Oh, old Gil lost his earring.
He calls it orthodenture also, which is like a good little detail.
Oh, it's fantastic. So, yeah, he's like, you know.
And by the way, Jean-Philippe, who is introduced as Elodie's brother is for sure fucking her.
100%.
And it is so funny 100%. That at no point Artie's like, wait a minute, are you fucking?
Yeah.
Because it's so clear.
Yeah, this guy's like 40 years older than her. And he's like, oh, this is my brother. And it's like, this is not your brother. This is for sure someone you're fucking. But Artie can't see it because Artie is like enamored with Elodie, and like, you know, she's doing a great job of manipulating him. He's like touching her ear at one point, and I was just like, oh god, Artie is such a creepy divorced dad.
Yeah.
So he goes over to Ralphie's place to get the Frenchman $50,000 he needs to invest in this shitty digestif, as you call it.
Never explained why you would need 50 grand to, you know.
It is for the marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one has heard of this here.
Yeah.
We need to secure the American rights.
Yeah. It's very like. For Artie is definitely too stupid to realize he's being played, because like, why do you need $50,000? Like, oh, because Iozzi gave him $100,000, and it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, it's very like, this guy, you know, keep Artie away from any emails from a Nigerian prince, because this dude will lose his money.
Also, it's weird to me that they don't, like, the first thing they don't do is like have him taste it.
Yeah, you'd
right?
figure.
Like, you're investing $50,000 into something that you don't know if it tastes like pure shit.
Oh, but the moment
but he
realizes
that bottle
it,
that he takes it out and he like doesn't really drink it.
It's a bottle moment, inside a wood thing. Of course, it's classy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The moment he realizes it's bad is one of my favorite scenes, but we'll get there. But first, Ralphie decides to ask, or Artie decides to ask Ralphie for the money. And Ralphie has one of my favorite scenes in the episode, in which...
oh my god, the opening?
The opening where Ralphie just clowns Vito.
Again, The Sopranos loves fat jokes.
Oh, it's
Can't
so
get
good.
Enough of them.
Yeah, I have a clip of that.
Oh, Chef Osobuco. This is a rare pleasure. Or is it medium well? Little restaurant humor. So, you know...
Again, such a Michael Imperioli line.
Yes, yes.
She brought along a pair of dirty chef whites. My friend here will suck out the stains for you.
And then the Three Stooges thing he does with his chin.
He jiggles his chins.
He jiggles his neck meat right in front of him while Vito just stares at him.
I once saw Marcella Arguello do this to a guy at a pool party.
Oh my god.
And it was one of the most fucked up, humiliating things I've ever seen happen to someone. And I was like, I was like, and y'all are friends.
To
like,
someone's neck fat?
It was to their boobs, but it was the same. It was a man's chest.
Marcella really knows how to hit you where it hurts. That's,
oh, God, yeah.
That is her ability. But
Ralphie is clearly the worst person, but also, and probably not coincidentally, like, the smartest gangster of them all.
Yeah, I mean.
He's like, he can see, like, four moves away. Like, no, of course I'm not going to lend you the money, because then I can't beat your ass when you don't pay me.
Right, exactly. I mean, Ralphie, you know, that's why he's a good earner, though. He kind of understands, you know, he's smart enough to know that this is not a bet worth taking.
He has no illusions about what being a gangster is.
Exactly.
I forgot
exactly.
What a psycho he was. It just, chilled me to my core again. I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah. He's a fucking psychopath. And luckily, he's a strategic psychopath, so he knows, you know, luckily he does not give Artie the money, and instead Tony gives him the money. But the reason Tony gives him the money is because Gloria, his ex-Kumar, kills herself, and he finds out about it while in bed with Carmella in a very sad scene in which, you know, Carmella is just kind of mentioning it offhanded because, like, she doesn't know that Tony and Gloria ever had a relationship. All she knows is one day at some point Gloria gave her a ride and she was checking out to see what the noise in her car was and finds out that Gloria had killed herself. And you
and
know
Tony,
you see Tony
the man. Lifelong gangster has the sudden realization that he might be a predatory person.
That he might be a toxic person.
Yeah.
Which is just an incredible realization for someone who's been in therapy for many, many years to have just then. But so Tony goes over, he does a little snooping himself to see what the deal is, and goes to Globe Motors and talks to someone who I can only describe as the worst fucking coworker on the face of God's green earth. A dude who immediately just is like, oh, Gloria's not around anymore. Actually, she died. Actually, she killed herself. Actually, yeah, she left a note, but it was selling something. It's like, why are you telling him all this, dude?
Right. Yeah. Worst coworker ever.
The worst coworker. This dude is a piece of shit. And
no, what it is that exposition needed to get out.
It did. Yeah. Yes.
And
yes.
He had to look like an asshole for it. And that is how writing works.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It's like every time you watch Law and Order SVU and mm-hmm. like two people are like talking about a case, suddenly out of nowhere Ice-T will walk in and it's as if he had been listening to everything that they heard and he just like adds one more piece to the thing,
right?
You he's know like, it's like everyone's yeah. discussing a murderer and he comes in, he's like, it's actually the guy's wife.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah,
how did you know what the fuck they were saying?
Yeah, how'd you know what they were talking about? And it's like, because we have to save time, the show's only 42 minutes
exactly
long.
And it's the same shit where it's so like painful when it happens because you're yeah. like, it's just so obvious. But
well, I thought they did something good with the scene though, beyond just going, god, why is this coworker saying everything? One of the things that Tony seems to be implying by asking these questions, like he's asking the question, did she leave a note? Did she say why? Did she say who?
Did she say it was because of me?
Did she say it was because of me? And did she leave a note? She like, no, but the police got it. And you see this look on his face going like, if this girl fucking snitched on me, like, not that there would be anything to snitch about. Like, what would she write? Tony was mean to me. Like, but he's still, there's part of him that's like concerned about how people look at him. And he's like, you know, he doesn't want to be the person known for driving someone to suicide. You know, he's got enough problems to use his words, but so the scene was useful, but I just like that coworker. I was like, ugh, what a slime ball. But he is also, you know, he's a car salesman,
right?
Yeah. Worst.
Tony flips out on Melfi, and Melfi of course does not fire him as a patient again for no reason, because you need therapy scenes and there's no firing him for that shit. Tony then spends the rest of the episode going through
blaming literally everyone but himself for
blaming
what
everyone but himself, and trying to get every single person in his life to call him a good guy, which is is just amazing. He decides to give a suit. First, he decides to
and
sign the living
suspicious.
Trust. Yeah, and everyone's like, why are you being nice? And he's like, what, am I a toxic person? And it's like, you just gave me a bunch of money for no reason. First, he signs the living trust for Carmela. That's been a storyline that's been building up for the last few, episodes. So he finally signs the trust. Then he decides to give Brian, cousin Brian, the hookup on some suits. Of course, those suits were stolen off the back of a truck. So,
but Brian's the only one that falls for Tony's plan in this way.
What do you mean? Like, he's the only one who accepts the
no? He's the only one that actually thinks Tony is a good guy for whatever favor he did them.
Well,
Carmela does too.
Sure,
Carmella,
yeah.
No, he does a good job of like manipulating people through his money in this episode.
I'm sorry. Tickets to Billy Joel will make me do anything. Am I right?
I mean, he knows like exactly what buttons to push on certain people. He takes out Janice for dinner. And if we're doing a favorite, least favorite right now, I'm going to say my favorite. And it's my favorite moment in this episode is the dinner between Janice and Tony at Vesuvio opens with Janice literally sucking the marrow out of a bone.
Yeah.
And going, I love marrow, which is the most, it's
so
like the
on
perfect.
The nose.
It's yeah. it is so. It's very on the nose for Janice. I mean, it's the most symbolically Janice thing ever to just literally be sucking the marrow out of a bone. And it's like,
yeah, my other favorite Janice thing that she does in that scene is like, Tony asks her if she ever has ever known anyone who committed suicide. And she goes, yeah, I used to live in Seattle. And I was wait, really is great. The person that Janice knows that committed suicide Kurt Cobain? Was that like the fucking... Of course I know Suicide. I lived in the city where Kurt Cobain was from.
I think there is, isn't there like a abnormally high suicide rate?
Yeah, because it's so rainy.
It's so
Everybody
rainy
has
and shit.
Seasonal and affective disorder.
Everyone's right. on heroin
I love
there.
If she counted Kurt Cobain as one of the
people. It was like, you mean besides Kurt Cobain?
But also yeah. she just did that very like incredible thing, of course, of centering the suicide stuff on her. Like where it was clear she didn't have a relationship with that neighbor at all.
Yeah.
But she was like, yeah. She's like, yeah, probably. I'd like to think I did have something to do with his death. She wanted to know him well enough to have for him to have killed himself about her.
Yeah, there's
that is such a fucking insanely toxic level of narcissism that is so real. It the is, way that she plays it is just so perfect.
It's the perfect Janice way to inject herself into Tony's grief is to be like, oh well, I personally have caused a little bit of a suicide myself.
Exactly.
So I'm
and
with
he was
you,
trying
brother.
To have empathy on a level like. How did you deal with it?
Right.
Yeah.
Instead of like her being like, well, actually, I've killed quite a few people myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you remember old Richie April, but I shot that dude in the heart. So Tony is trying to make amends with people in his life. And every time they question his motives, he yells, what am I, a toxic person? which, yes, he is very toxic. I feel like this is the first time it's 2002. This is the first time the idea of toxic people really entered the lexicon.
Right.
It feels like, because like nowadays,
everything's a toxic workplace.
Everything is toxic. Like there's so much, being toxic carries so much weight now that you can be called out for just being toxic. Like you see like workplaces being like, it was a toxic work environment. And without going into specifics, people are like, Jesus, I'm sorry. And you're like, well, what happened?
Right.
And then they're like, toxicness. And you're like, okay, but like this was the beginnings of hearing about the idea of a toxic person as this kind of like almost ethereal description of somebody's mishigas without actually getting into the nuts and bolts. Like, how are you toxic? Well, I use people and I murder them sometimes. But so he's really struggling with the idea that he might be toxic, and he decides to give Artie $50,000 in a loan with a better percentage. I love that he's like, come on, take my money. I'll give you a better percentage. He's still doing usury, but he's doing it at a discounted rate, and I appreciate
it's
that.
It's a point and a half. Come on.
A
I'm
point
not
and
like
a half.
That other guy.
It's just a small percentage. Of course, things do not go the way that Artie thought they would, and the Frenchman stops taking his calls completely, and he confronts Tony to be like, hey, what should I do? And Tony tells him, you have to go over there, right? You
right
have to well, fucking-
yeah he tells him like, if the longer you let it go on, the more he's gonna make it seem like he's doing you a favor to pay you back.
I wonder if Artie is feeling like, wait, is he talking about the Frenchman or is he talking about me?
Oh, well, that's the whole thing. I think that's what's so brilliant about it is it's he's giving him a lesson that he's teaching. It's a circle.
Right. So he's not sure if he's like, if he's saying, yeah, I have to go over and beat up the Frenchman or else Tony's going to beat the shit out of me. And so Artie has this amazing scene where he is practicing being tough in a mirror. And I have a clip of that.
Oh, Jean-Philippe, I called you 5 times. Qu'est-ce que c'est? Message machine broken. Nice crib. Was that the Berber carpet? You fucking avoiding me, motherfucker? Where's my money? Oh, what are you gonna cry now, huh? Stand up, you frog-eating fudge to guts. I will fuck you up, man.
A few minutes later.
Jean-Philippe, you're home. Qu'est-ce que c'est, man? Message machine broken.
I'm sorry, I've been wishing to call you.
Nice crib. You were supposed to give me my money 2 days ago.
I know. But Crédit Lyonnais, they didn't come through with a second round of financing yet.
I want my money.
I just told you, I don't have it.
Well, When are you going to get it?
I don't know, okay?
I have a daughter who needs braces.
Listen to me. I don't have it right now.
You fucking French fucking lion cocksucker. My earring. I want my money. Fuck you.
If I see you again, I'd kill you.
That was very much like the Big Lebowski, but my girlfriend lost her toe.
Yeah. It's not fair.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, Artie is such a tragic and pathetic figure. And watching him fail so miserably, not only at like doing gangster shit, but also at like trying to fuck a Lodi. Like,
yeah,
he's got really huge, like, incel energy.
Huge incel energy.
So bad. It's yeah. Like, he's like, I'm a nice guy.
Yeah,
I put
yeah.
two nice tokens in. Now I get one French 20-year-old pussy out. The rules. And it's so fucked up and upsetting. It's like, that's not, you're not nice. You're not nice. Fucking make your wife not feel like she's your fucking.
Yeah, right. I love that, the idea of him being like, if I don't get the pussy, then I'm pressing the coin return back and getting my nice back. And by that, I mean being a cunt to everyone.
And she's just playing him so well. The thing where she's like, oh, I'm getting so fat because of your gnocchis. And then she shows him her.
She's giving me a belly.
Yeah, shows him her belly.
Yeah. I'm getting a belly. And just and he's just like openly horny on Maine for her. He's just looking at her like, And she's like, and just fucking playing him so good, like a fucking fiddle.
T, I have a CD for you.
Yeah, I love, she's like, I have a compact disc. It is bad music that I got for free. But yeah, it is just wild just watching him just kind of get totally fucking played. And
a man on the street, he gave me the CD. I saved the CD for you, Artie.
For those of you,
Artie, hold on. I will go fuck my brother on a pile of your money.
I just love, no one can see right now, but you on the Zoom, she has added a filter where she has a French beret on, and it is, it's really adding a lot to the character. You're the only one who's ever come on this podcast and done some serious visual character work, and I appreciate that about you.
That's extra points for sure.
Extra points.
Oh, I'm graduating.
So stupid. And finally, we get to...
Oh, Bugatti.
So dumb. Oh, we get to... Artie committing suicide or attempting to commit suicide. He calls up Tony, and Tony finally in this episode gets a chance to undo what he thinks is the previous suicide he caused in Gloria by calling the cops and saving Artie and having his stomach pumped. And they have this scene in the hospital that I think is great, in which like Tony, you know, explains to him, you know, that he shouldn't commit suicide and that suicide is bad, and basically decides to forgive his debt. And Artie uses the opportunity to tell Tony that he planned this all along in one of the, I can only imagine is like this is like a David after dentist type high that he's in, where he's just saying all of the things that he should be keeping on the inside.
Yeah.
I mean, What could compel him to be like, oh, I get it. You planned all of this so that you could eat for free. Real sickening. And of course, Tony freaks out and he says my favorite line, which I'm not sure it was written or just a take that they kept. But he goes, you fucking suicide. He calls him a fucking suicide. Which is a strange thing to call somebody, but
and also he like literally takes it back and is like, "You should have fucking killed yourself." I'm like, "Well, that's a nice thing to do." Literally, right after someone does that,
and you know, I think what's interesting about it is the thing that I think makes him the most angry about it is the fact, not that he, you know, didn't plan, because he knows he did. He knows he's right. He knows that like fucking he was in his deep subconscious, he knew that Artie was going to fuck this up and he would be able to eat for free. I think he's absolutely right about that. But he's more mad about the fact that, like, had he killed himself, then people would think that he's bad, that Tony is bad. You know, he's more interested and concerned about his image as someone who drives people to suicide than he is about his image as, like, someone who murders people and is, you know, someone who does usury. So,
it's also kind of fun to see Tony treat Artie the way Artie treats Elodie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where he was like, I just fucking made you nice. I did nice to you. You don't fucking tell me I'm nice now. You fucking owe me.
Oh, I love it. I love the tables turning on Artie. I also feel terrible for him, and I hope at some point that he gets to fuck again, because no dude is ever needed to fuck more so than AJ.
Yeah, all the cum is like rotting his brain.
All the cum is building inside of him, making him make stupid decisions.
No one needs to fuck more than his wife.
I know.
Are you kidding me?
I know.
That's got to be the trashest dick of all time.
Oh.
There's Absolutely. No way.
There's no way. That dude.
Like, that woman has stopped trying to get dick because of how trash it is.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, I literally would rather die with a fucking dap than attempt to make this sexual connection with you on any level.
Yeah, yeah. That dry ass pussy forever rather than ever letting Artie Bucco back in. That is a fact. You're spitting facts. But yeah, and so he doesn't commit suicide. Tony goes to see Billy Joel. And Carmela successfully hooks up Furio with some girl he knows that we've never heard of. And apparently she's going to give him free dental shit. That is the episode. Do you, Vince, have a favorite or a least favorite scene?
I have both. Favorite was definitely like AJ trying to hide his boner. Mm. And then least favorite was the music that was playing while Christopher gets high on heroin for the second time. And I don't know if you remember that song, but I have a little bit of that.
Why don't you go bitching on my soul? You came out with a Mississippi mo. Rock and roll. Kentucky Fried Flow. What you do that for? Whoa, Domino. Why you won't go?
It sounds like what Christopher thinks rap is.
Yes. It is that not also by the Alabama 3?
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't it sound like the people who are doing the
song intro song?
It's by a German DJ named Armand von Helden.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh.
It just sounds like he's doing that voice, though.
It does.
Yeah. It sounds like he wrote the song for The Sopranos, hoping that the Alabama 3 would hear it and invite him and make him the fourth in the Alabama 4.
It's your cousin, Marvin Alabama 3. You know that new sound you were looking for?
It is god-awful. And it's, once again, just a testament to David Chase's very hit or miss musical choices in The Sopranos. And that to me is like, just imagining that on heroin is bumming me out.
Yeah. Imagining it not on heroin is bumming me out.
I mean, yeah.
Bad vibes.
Bad vibes all around. Sophia, do you have a favorite or least favorite?
I mean, I do like the D'Angelo song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I'm still just mad that Devin Pillsbury was not a Pillsbury heiress. So that's my least favorite.
Your least
moment.
Favorite was,
it just seemed like putting a hat on a hat. Like, oh, yeah. Pillsbury, the financial man. Like, if you introduce like three Pep brothers in the show, suddenly invent another story. Yes, they're the Pep boys,
but
not from the automotive parts company.
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
They're the litigation Pep boys. They're very big in the litigation community.
Favorite moment was probably that even even though I really like that dream sequence with the scarf and the chandelier, the part that absolutely cracks me up every time is when she's like, Tony, do you want to see this?
Yeah,
right. Do you want to see this? And I just know that whoever wrote it was like, yeah, because both, get it? It's a fucking wound. Get it? Ladies are axe wounds. You fucking get it? And so, that part always makes me laugh.
It's interesting because I took something different from that, which was that Tony just wanting to see a vagina is a strange thing. Like, I just, there's this thing where, like, just being like, do you want to see it? And it's like, well, yeah, but I want to see it incidentally as part of a whole thing in which my mouth's on it and stuff. Like, the idea of seeing it. And then she was like, or do you want to see this? And I was like, oh, we're doing a thing. Okay. We're doing a thing. I like it. Like I said, I think my favorite is probably Janice sucking Meryl or already trying Armagnac for the first time when he's trying to kill himself and realizing it tastes like shit and crying. Just if only he had tried it first, he would have avoided the whole thing. Least favorite thing, Furio showing up at the Frenchman's door. Only because, like, inside me, there's a dumb guy who just needs to see the revenge, you know? There's, like, I understand.
We see the Frenchman get the shit beat out of him?
Because they're like, no, we imply it. Obviously, Furio shows up. You know some shit's going down. It's like, yeah, but I kind of want to see it. Like, I fucking hate that French
at this
dude.
Stage of the show, people had already started telling David Chase what, like, the parts that they demanded to see. And, like,
and yes,
David
and
Chase gets off on being like, fuck you, it's my show, I'll show you what I want, piggies.
He really does. That's exactly right. It's like, at this point, he has read all of the New York Post takes about previous episodes in which, how come they're not doing more violence? And he's just like, this season, I'm going to have no violence. Fuck you all.
Yeah.
And there's going to be no ending and no more tits ever again. Yeah, so that's my least favorite. I think in this episode, the real gangster is neither Artie nor AJ. Finally, all in all, I would have to say this episode, I would give it a solid B+. Vince, what would you give this episode?
Oh, you raise an interesting question. You know, a lot of things happened. There was a lot of character development, some very good arcs and some story. I mean, yeah, I gotta go. Tough decision, but I gotta go solid B+ as well.
Oh, all right. It's a surprising answer. Let's see. Sophia, if you had to rate this episode with like a letter grade, what would you give this episode?
I'm heavily leaning towards giving it a B+.
Okay.
Brave.
Well,
I just did it.
All right. Fair enough. B+ of an episode. And I would say solid B+ of an episode of this show. Pod yourself a gun. Sophia Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Yay. And I'm glad you had fun. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at The Sophia, SOFIYA, on Twitter and Instagram, and you should buy my album Father's Day.
Buy Father's Day now, in stores or online, right?
Online.
Buy it online. Don't go to stores. COVID's still around.
Who would go to a store?
I don't know. It seems like...
where are we going?
Tower Records? Is that still
a thing? Yeah, exactly. Fuck yeah.
It's still around. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you everyone out there for listening. Before we go, we have a bunch of new patrons who just signed up for the Pod Yourself a Shout Out tier.
Oh, geez.
That means that Vince, you're going to have to give out some names.
All right. Who do we got?
Okay. First, we're starting with Allison Booten.
Oh, Allison Booten, the boot. Allie the boot.
That's good. I like that. Last name is Booten, like the Booten Projects.
Yeah. Hey, you Booten?
Hey, you Booten over here. All right.
Vladimir Booten?
Hey, we call you.
That's too clever for a mafia nickname.
Yeah. Vince makes him the least clever possible. All right. Next is Matthew Rowles.
Oh, Rouse, we call him the virus because he's, because he's always contagious.
Okay, because he's very good, very good. Mm-hmm. Next is Patrick Williams.
Oh, Patty Will. Yeah, we call him Patty Will because his name's Patrick Williams. We're not very creative in the mafia.
That's fair enough. Next is Scott Rivet.
Oh, hey, we call him Rosie. Scotty the Riveter, we call him Rosie because he likes to put the steel on the...
That actually is, I think, unintentionally very good. The next is Will Thompson.
Oh, yeah, Will Thompson. Yeah, we call him, we call him Asian Will.
Asian Will. All right. Asian Will. Next is Melissa Cat. I don't know how to pronounce this. Melissa Cat Tusk.
Melissa Cat. We call her Big Pussy.
All right. That's good. Yeah. Big Pussy is fair. All right. Now, Travis Kerrigan.
Every woman's dream nickname.
Yeah. It works less with a woman, but I think it also, in a way, works more with a woman. Sorry about that, Melissa. Melissa Big Pussy Katsukek. That is a hard name to say. And finally, Travis Kerrigan.
Oh, Travis Kerrigan. Yeah, we call him Travis the Neck because he lives down neck. He's got, you know.
All right. You got there. You got there. Yeah, all right. Those are your shout outs for the week. Once again, that's patreon.com/fraughtcast. Join now for bonus episodes of our other podcasts in which we talk about things other than The Sopranos. Fraughtcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
Don't stop. That was so fun.